Well, we've reached that point I'm sure you're most excited about, and that's part three of cracking the code on the gut-gene connection. And this is the part that I love most to teach. This is the part where we explain how the food that you're eating is affecting your genes. This is where we're going to clear up the confusion about, should I be paleo or should I be a vegan? Should I be on a high-fat diet or a low-fat diet? Lots of carbs, no carbs. This will clear it up for you when you take a look at your genes and when you match your genes and foods. So what's the right diet for you? You'll soon have the skills to be able to figure that out. So let's look at the genes that will tell you what you need to know to really be able to honor the principle of uniqueness. I hope that's one thing that's come across loud and clear so far, is you are very unique. There's only one of you, and you are going to need a special diet just for you. I do want to remind you that diet rapidly and reproducibly alters the gut microbiome. So what you eat, as you know, is affecting the bacteria and the other microbes that are down in our gut. It's the same thing with the genes, because you see, the microbes have their own set of genes. We have our 23,000 genes. There are trillions of them, remember, and they have, each one of them has their own set of genes. So the food you're eating is affecting you, every cell in your body, of course. They're affecting your gut bacteria, and they're affecting your genes. They're either expressing them or silencing them. In other words, turning them off, turning them on, helping them work efficiently, or slowing them down, and or making them work too fast. That's another problem. So if diet not only alters the gut microbiome, it alters our genes all the time. Now, if we're going to get more into the terminology, you'll want to use the term, or know what the term intervention means. An intervention is a fix for a gene. So if you've got a gene that isn't working right, then you say to yourself, okay, what's the fix for that? What's the intervention? Since I've been looking at this for a while now, certain things have jumped out loud and clear. Nobody has genes for a lot of sugar in their diet, absolutely not. But the genes prefer an 80% vegetable diet. And interestingly enough, so do the gut bacteria. Body Ecology for years has promoted an 80% plant-based diet with a small 10 to 20% of animal protein. That means that you'll be mostly eating lots of vegetables throughout the day in smoothies, in salads. You'll steam them, you'll roast them. Just get them in your food all the time and, of course, ferment them. And sea vegetables are wonderful, too. Don't forget about the sea vegetables. The perfect diet for your genes also has a little bit of fruit, but it has to be low-sugar fruit. Again, looking back at the microbiome, they like a little bit of sugar, the kind of sugar that you'd find in a blueberry or raspberry or a grapefruit maybe, but they don't like the amount of sugar that you're going to find in a candy bar. That's just too much for them. And especially if you're eating foods with sugar in them all throughout the day, that's going to kill the bacteria in your gut. And it's also going to have a very negative impact on your genes, causing the ones that you don't want to be expressed to be expressed, causing diseases like diabetes, heart disease, and cancer. So that's the takeaway. A high vegetable diet is an intervention for our genes. If you have high blood pressure, you wouldn't want to have a lot of sodium in your diet. You would want to eat a lot of potassium-rich foods. So potatoes would be an intervention for your genes. I've said for years that all foods have their front and their back. One man's food could be another man's poison, and this is a perfect example right here. So let's start with the bitter taster gene. If you were a little child and you came into this world with a bitter taster gene, you were probably one of those kids that your mom couldn't get to eat broccoli, Brussels sprouts, collard greens, kale, and all of us know today how beneficial the cruciferous family of vegetables is for us. You may still be avoiding those because you have that bitter taster gene and as a child you refuse to eat them. But one good thing about this gene, the bitter taster gene, is while the vegetables will taste bitter to you, you can learn to love them. You can learn to love the bitter taste, in other words, and you really, really should. A lot of times when people have the bitter taster gene, they tend to want to put something on their Brussels sprouts or their broccoli. So they'll load it with a big glop of butter. They'll sprinkle it with a lot of salt, and that could be a problem, especially today, because the quality of salt that most of us are getting isn't really even salt at all. It's this sort of chemical stuff that we are pouring on our food and putting in our food, particularly all the commercial food. And this is even more dangerous, of course. So we recommend a high-quality salt like the Celtic sea salt for cooking. But with a bitter taster gene, what you could do is sprinkle a little bit of balsamic vinegar on your Brussels sprouts. Be sure you buy balsamic vinegar that is aged in wood. Of course, apple cider vinegar is always a plus, and you might love kale or collards with a little apple cider vinegar sprinkled on them. And yes, you can definitely have a little bit of fat, a little bit of butter, grass-fed butter, ghee on your vegetables if your genes tell you that saturated fats are good for you. And of course, it's always got to be high-quality saturated fats. I will be giving you more information about saturated fats in just a moment. You want to remember the RS number is how you're going to look up that gene if you're doing research on the internet. Really want you to, you know, check out this gene because unfortunately a lot of people, a lot of children are avoiding eating these wonderful cruciferous vegetables because they have this gene. If you want to learn more about the bitter taster gene, you want to look up a gene by its RS number. So on this slide, I actually put down two different RS numbers. You can start doing some research and look up the bitter taster gene. Of course, you'll have to do a test to find out if you have the bitter taster genes. And if you're real curious, the chemical that you'll find in broccoli and Brussels sprouts and the dark green leafy vegetables that give that vegetable a bitter taste is called phenylthiocarbamide. And I'll spell it for you. It's phenylthiocarbamide, M-I-D-E. Wow. And we've got to talk about salt. You know, salt is one of those components in food that has so much wrong information out there in the world floating around, confusing us. Some people truly are salt sensitive, and there are genes that will indicate that you are. And those people do have to be careful about the amount of salt they bring into their body. If they have a small amount of salt, they want to be sure that the salt that they do take in is very, very high quality. So if you look at this slide, you'll see that here are some genes that are all connected to salt sensitivity. Some of the easy ones to find are the ACE gene, the AGT, and the NOS3. The ACE gene, for example, there's a lot of research showing that you're going to have a higher blood pressure response, so your blood pressure will go up if you are increasing the amount of sodium in your diet. Salt-sensitive people are at a greater risk for heart attack and hypertension. And if you're not salt-sensitive, in other words, you could be salt-resistant. And if you are salt-resistant, then you can have more salt. But again, I can't stress enough the importance of high-quality salt. About 38% of the population carries the ACE gene that you'll see on this slide. In other words, there's a SNP or a variant in the ACE gene, and this decreases their ability to deal with the salt, and it puts them at greater risk for having a high blood pressure. So that's an example of somebody who's salt sensitive. And so another gene that's associated with salt sensitivity is NOS3, NOS3. About 26% of the people have an issue with the NOS3 gene, and that's related to cardiovascular disease. That's what the research is showing. And then the AGT is another commonly researched gene. About 66% of us have this gene and have this genetic variation, in other words. See, this is an example, I think, of how common these genetic SNPs are today, but how important it is to know what your genes are telling you about how to eat. Now, let's talk a little bit more about salt. People who are really, really at risk here that have these genes are people who are eating the typical American diet. that's because the food that they're eating in restaurants and their fast food chains and that they're buying in the store that are prepared, whether they're canned or frozen, they're loaded with salt. They put the salt in there because salt is addictive too in it, and they want you to come back and buy their product. But it's very poor quality salt. It doesn't have the minerals. It's got other chemicals in it. It's not salt, really. So when you hear these studies and they say, oh, salt is connected to high blood pressure or cardiovascular disease, I always say, well, what kind of salt did you use in your study and who did you test? Really and truly, if you ask me, they need to go through every study that's ever been done. And this is true for many of the genes. Redo those studies looking at people's genes. If you take out all the people who are salt sensitive and have one of these genes, you're going to find people who are fine with salt if it's good salt. And salt is very life-saving, a very important food. I always recommend the Celtic sea salt for cooking. If you are salt sensitive, however, I just say be careful, you know, don't oversalt your food. If you're making a pot of soup, let's say, and you put in a teaspoon or two of the high-quality Celtic sea salt, you're not going to eat that entire pot of soup in one sitting. You're going to eat a bowl at a time, so you're not getting that much salt. If you want a little more salt sprinkled on your food, on a salad or your broccoli or whatever, top of your eggs, take a product like Herbamare. It's spelled H-E-R-B-A-M-A-R-E. I think that's how you pronounce it, Herbamare. I've actually been recommending this product for 25 years to people, and I really honestly don't know how it's pronounced, but I know it's spelled H-E-R-B-A-M-A-R-E, and it's a great seasoning. It's got a little bit of biodynamic salt and a lot of herbs, and it's delicious, and it's great for people that are salt sensitive, and everybody else too. The recommended amount of salt for somebody who is salt sensitive is a half a teaspoon of salt a day. And actually, that's quite a lot of salt. I mean, you're not going to, if you take a half a teaspoon of salt and put it on a spoon, you're not going to be sprinkling that all over, you know, that much over everything you're eating. So, you know, a half a teaspoon of salt, high quality salt, is the secret for salt sensitive people. So this is a really great gene to know about. Especially because we do have a lot of salt, and salt makes our food taste delicious. And it's an important, you know, there's a lot of information about the importance of having salt in our blood, and especially for the adrenals. Now let's talk about the gene, the TAS1R3. The RS number for this gene is RS3574483. You just might want to do more research on the sweet taster gene. Of course, you have to have your genes tested to find out if you are a sweet taster. But if you have this, you will tend to be much more addictive to sugars because they cause the dopamine response to be much greater. In other words, you eat sugar and your nucleus accumbens makes more dopamine. It's very addictive. It's real hard to get off of sugar if you start eating it. As you know, commercially made foods are designed to be very addictive. They want you to come back and buy that candy bar, that cookie, or a piece of cake or whatever again. And they put sugar in everything. I just want to remind you, as somebody who's been teaching the perfect diet for candidiasis or systemic yeast infections for 25 years, sugar feeds yeast. And most of us do have yeast in our body today. Since anybody from about the age 50 down was probably born with yeast. And so having this gene, you're even more at risk, but the rest of us are too, because sugar's everywhere. We get addicted to it early in life. So what's the secret for getting off of a sugar addiction? Well, I'll share several important tips for you. First of all, it takes 4 days to break the sugar addiction. So even though it's hard, you have to use your willpower for 4 days, and after the fourth day, it gets much easier. Especially during that 4 days, you want to drink a whole lot of water. You can squeeze lemon juice into the water and put in stevia. We have really delicious stevia that I personally use it all the time because I'm not a great water drinker, but if I put a little bit of lemon juice and a couple of drops of stevia in there, I find it much more delicious, and I drink a lot more water that way. So drink And that little bit of sweetness to make yourself sort of a lemonade will help that desire for sugar. And the other tip that I have for you is to eat fermented foods. The coconut kefir, people all over the world know how good coconut kefir is for stopping cravings for sugar. And fermented vegetables are great, and the probiotic liquids that we sell are wonderful too. If you eat fermented sour foods and then you go eat something sweet, like a candy bar or a cookie, it's way, way too sweet for you. However, if you eat a carrot, which are blueberries or raspberries, they taste very sweet to you because sour dampens your desire for sugar, but it also allows you to taste the sweetness in fruits and vegetables. So you find yourself eating, being very satisfied with a very little bit of sugar. Some of us do have this sweet taster gene. And if you're one of those people, be careful because we live in a world where there's lots and lots of foods out there that are going to cause you to be addicted. And the manufacturers, are controlling you because of your gene, the sweet taster gene, the TAS1R3. Let's talk about gluten because everybody is these days. Do you have celiac disease? Well, very few people actually do. And there's a couple of genes that you can look at that will tell you if you've inherited the inability to assimilate and digest gluten. And when you eat it, it really can inflame the gut and make you quite sick. Those genes are called DQ2.5 and DQ8. Cyrex Labs is a company that has by far the most accurate test out there for testing whether you're gluten sensitive. And there's a difference. People that are true celiacs have these genes and should always avoid gluten. Everybody else, in my opinion, should avoid gluten anyway, because usually what you do with gluten is you find it in foods like cookies and cakes and pancakes and bread and all the places that, oh, and usually it comes with sugar, but you know, they're flour products, and flour products are never healthy for the gut. And again, this is a gut gene program, so we want you to eat healthy foods for the gut, healthy foods for your genes. Gluten is not a healthy food for gut or for genes. Right now, 30% of people really prefer to be gluten-free, and it's an enormous market. If you go into the health food store, you'll see gluten-free signs popping out everywhere. And many, many products have the words gluten-free labeled on their packaging. But really, only 1% to 2% of us truly have a genetic problem with gluten. Bottom line here is, please don't eat gluten. It's a great food to cut out of your diet forever. Your gut bacteria will thank you for that, and so will your genes. Then you have probably wondered all your life, am I lactose intolerant? I don't seem to be able to do dairy foods very well. You might be lactose intolerant, and you can have your genes tested very easily, and you can find out if you are. I am not lactose intolerant, but most of my life, I mean, even as a tiny baby, I did not do well on dairy. I now know that I probably started life with the wrong gut bacteria, and I didn't digest a lot of foods, actually, and they had trouble finding, you know, milk to feed me. Today, however, I have no problem with dairy. I know how to eat it, but I'm not lactose intolerant, so that was an interesting thing to find out. But it's not just about the lactose. It's also about other components, and while I have no problem with the lactose, I do have issues with the fat in the milk, so I'm one of those people that can't take saturated fat, and I would do better on a low-fat fermented milk. Now, why did I say fermented? Because if you ferment your, say, raw goat's milk, and you are lactose intolerant, you can count on the bacteria eating up most of the lactose, and you can and there's a very good chance that you can actually have fermented milk, kefir. Now, I say kefir over yogurt. Kefir is a far superior food because it's loaded with more bacteria, particularly if you make it at home. We have a wonderful, very easy-to-make recipe and starter that will you can make the kefir right in your own home. I love making it. It's as easy to make as Kool-Aid. You just have to, you know, stir the starter together with your high-quality milk. You let it sit out on the counter for 24 hours, and it becomes kefir, where Where Kool-Aid, you can drink it right away. You have to wait 24 hours for the kefir, but it's obviously a far superior food. So yes to kefir, even if you're lactose intolerant. And in my opinion, you should always ferment your dairy anyway. Fermenting breaks down the proteins, the fats, and of course, the bacteria eat up the sugar. I think a lot of people are having problems with dairy because the quality of the dairy is poor. In our country, we have, our milk comes from cows that produce A1 casein. And there's a difference between A1 casein and A2 casein. A2 casein is found in breast milk, goat's milk, camel milk, sheep milk, mare's milk, if you can get hold of that. Some places in the world, they do drink mare's milk, and they ferment it, by the way, into a product called kumis. But the point I'm trying to make is that the milk, the protein, has to be an A2 protein to be healthy for us. And we have all been drinking A1 milk. So if you buy goat milk, you're good. You have an A2 protein. That's why I think many people do well on goat's milk or sheep milk instead of cow milk. It's because of the quality of the casein, A1 versus A2. What I do in the morning is I'll take a little bit of homemade goat milk kefir. I'll put it in a glass, and then I add in Energy Biotic or Cocoa Biotic. Those are two probiotic liquids that we sell at Body Ecology. And I've just diluted the kefir, and I've also added even more beneficial bacteria, and it's much, much easier to digest that way. One thing to know about milk is it's dehydrating. Remember, I've said that all foods have a positive and negative side to them in front and the back. So the good side to having a little bit of dairy is that it's great for building muscles, but there are some negative sides, and one of those is that it's dehydrating. So I think I would highly recommend that you always dilute it, at least with water, but I do either both, a little bit of our probiotic liquid and water, or just the probiotic liquid. And you don't have much at a time when you have it, and you want to have it fermented. That's the big thing to know about dairy. Now, again, watch the fat, because it may be the fat that you are reacting to. You may not be one of those people that can have saturated fat. There's lots of us who can't, in spite of the fact that butter, lard, bacon, and cream are very, very popular today. If you're going to eat cheese, I have one precaution, and that is that it's very, very constipating. So you want to eat a small amount. A great way to eat it would be to grate a small amount into a big, nice raw salad, and you're going to have all that fiber from the salad helping push the cheese through your digestive tract. I have a little protocol that I have recommended to people at times. I call it my 3-day gut reset program. And what I have people do is take the milk kefir. You know, it's kind of like in the very beginning of our life, we go back to the very start of our inner ecosystem, and we are babies and we're only having milk to drink. So for people with SIBO, what I have done several times very successfully is to take the raw milk kefir, and every single hour they will put some in a glass with water or the probiotic liquid, and they drink it. An hour, hour and a half later, they come back and have a little more again, and they keep doing that all throughout the day while they're taking a bifidus strain of bacteria. I often recommend Flora Baby, which is a Renew Life product. So they're drinking water, they're having this diluted, fermented milk kefir, and diluted, when I say diluted, with one of our probiotic liquids and water, and they're drinking that all day long. You can do this for one day, you can do this for 2 days, you can even do this for 3 days. What most people report is they feel wonderful. At the same time, I have them on herbs like oil of oregano, berberine, cat's claw, bamboo extract. These are good things that help kill the bad bacteria in the gut while you're repopulating it, really, sort of resetting that inner ecosystem. It's, you know, I've advised several people on doing it, suggested it to people, and got really, really positive feedback, and have found it to be good for myself, too. One of the reasons that people find dairy foods constipating is because they lack bifidus bacteria. And a little bit further on, I'm going to talk to you more about another gene that's very much related to Bifidus bacteria. If you take a look at the picture of lactose intolerant, you'll notice that many of these foods can be very high in saturated fat. Well, saturated fat is back. A slew of recent magazines and newspaper articles, plus tons of information on the web, plus the Weston A. Price Association has always recommended that people eat a lot of fat. So people follow that, thinking that it's the right thing to do, when in fact it may not be right for their genes. This is a really important area, I think, where nutritional genomics is going to make a huge and very important impact on our health. Saturated fat is also found in red meat, full-fat dairy, butter, egg yolks. Of course, there are plant-saturated fats too, like coconut oil and palm kernel oil. Well, there's a difference, a big, big difference between the fats that come from animal foods and the fats that come from the plant kingdom, like avocado, for example. And I'm a very, very big believer in eating eggs and the yolk of the eggs, not the white as much. It's the yolk that's really special for all those people that have been avoiding the yolk for years. They're missing a really important fat for their brain, for the thyroid, for the ovaries. So please, that's not a place to cut down on your saturated fat. I want to make that very clear. So there are certain genes that I've studied and would like to report on. There are probably many more. Remember that nutritional genomics is an infant science, and over the next 5, 10, 20 years, a lot more information coming down the pike for us, which is fantastic. So high fat, low fat, what's right for you? This is one of the most controversial topics of all. Butter, lard, and bacon, you know, so many people are enjoying these. They taste delicious. Fat is a source of energy. For some people, they are fantastic. If you have the APOE gene, you have to look real carefully to see if you're 3-4 or 4-4. So that would be APOE 3-4, APOE 4-4. This particular group of people are often concerned about being at risk for Alzheimer's. Again, more coming down the pike on that. But this is a group of people that really do well on a very definitely 80% plant-based diet, maybe even 90%. They really have to watch their sugar, no sugar in their diet whatsoever. And the fats that they eat are very, very important. Heart disease is often associated with a high-fat diet. But the more we've looked at heart disease recently, the more we realize that inflammation from many sources, even viruses and having a systemic fungal infection in your body, can cause the hardening, the plaque, for example, that causes heart disease. So it may not be the fat. That's what a lot of people are questioning. And of course, the good healthy fats, the omega-3 fats, even high quality omega-6 fats, plus borage, evening primrose, these can protect us from heart disease. The PPARG gene is definitely related to weight gain and diabetes. So people with the PPAR gene SNP, remember the variation, so the gene's not functioning like it's supposed to, if they're eating a lot of fats and if they've got a lot of sugar in their diet, they're really, really in trouble. No problem with MUFAs, which are monounsaturated fatty acids. No problem. That would be like olive oil, for example. And even the PUFAs, which are polyunsaturated fatty acids. And usually when you see the PUFAs, they're referring to the omega-3 oils. Avocado, for example, is considered a MUFA. Fish oil would be considered a PUFA. So the MUFAs and the PUFAs are no problem for you if you're a PPAR gene SNP. Carbohydrates, again, as I mentioned before, absolutely very important to stay on a low-carbohydrate diet for you. The key genes that you want to check are the APOE3, 4, and 4-4, the APOA2, and you'll notice here in this slide it says the C or the T SNP. These are the two variations. If you have, remember there's a wild type, which means that your gene is working normally, and then there's the C or T SNP. Those are the variations. Then the PPAR gene, as I mentioned before, which is related to diabetes as well, and the ADIPOQ gene. We're going to quickly skim through these just to make my point. Let's look at the APOA2 slide, and you'll notice I put the RS number. If you're looking up these genes, you want to look them up by their RS number. Even if you go into the raw data from 23andMe, it's your RS number that you're going to be looking for. Now, the APOA2 regulates your after-meal response to saturated fat. What happens after you eat the butter, the bacon, the lard in your meal? The APOA2 has two SNPs that you want to look at. You could either be APOA2C or APOA2T. So if you're on a high-fat diet and you're eating a lot of butter and bacon, lots of cream, and you find that you have the APOA2C variant, then saturated fats are going to put weight on you. Saturated fats will make you fat. If you have the T variant, then the saturated fat won't make you fat. So what I did to be able to remember this is put the word T equal trim. So if you're the T variant, T equal trim, and C equal chubby. That might be a good way to remember it, and that's how I remember it. Let's say you have no idea what you are. So what would be your intervention? Well, if you choose to follow a low-fat diet anyway, no matter what you have, the APOA2T or the APOA2C, you won't be gaining weight because you're on a low-fat diet and you got yourself covered. Well, is this the best approach? I would say not necessarily. I would say if you don't know, you want to eat more of the fats that we know tend to be good for everybody, the MUFAs and the PUFAs. I do want to point out, though, that if you are the APOE3-4 or 4-4, even the MUFAs and PUFAs should be kept to a very, very low minimum for you and maybe not even used at all. Then you've got your ADIPOQ gene. Again, I've put the RS number on there. People with the ADIPOQ gene are at higher risk for obesity and type 2 diabetes. What is adiponectin? Well, it's a hormone, a very important hormone that helps you maintain your insulin sensitivity. So we produce insulin, of course. The beta cells in our pancreas produce insulin. And then we want our cells to be very sensitive to that insulin so that it works efficiently and we metabolize carbohydrates in our diet efficiently. We have energy. So adiponectin is a hormone that helps maintain insulin sensitivity on the surface of the cells that produce energy. So it's a really important hormone for energy. The ADIPOQ gene is a very important gene for diabetes and also obesity too. Adiponectin is a hormone that helps maintain insulin sensitivity on the cells, you know, on the surface of the cells that produce energy. In your muscles and in your liver cells, adiponectin initiates fat burning and the utilization of glucose, our sugar. And this results in the reduction of fat and it improves insulin sensitivity. So in other words, adiponectin is a good hormone. We want adiponectin. Low levels are not good. So if you have the variant of the ADIPOQ gene, you're at higher risk for obesity and type 2 diabetes, as I mentioned. But one of the things that research has found is you can reduce this risk with calorie restriction, so lowering the amount of food you're eating, like don't overeat, and then also a low-fat diet for these people. The ADIPOQ gene actually contains the instructions for making the hormone adiponectin. And remember, you want high healthy levels of adiponectin. Now, that's the hormone made exclusively by the fat cells in your body, so you can see why it's related to gaining weight. This hormone travels through the blood, targeting your muscles and your liver cells. And it helps these muscle and liver cells use glucose efficiently so that they have energy. And if you've got a problem with this gene, and of course you're eating poorly, all the wrong foods, eating too much fat, the wrong kind of fats, then, and especially if you're eating sugar, you're going to get fatty liver disease. It's called non-alcoholic fatty liver disease. You're not drinking alcohol, but you're making a liver that looks like an alcoholic full of fat. So just in a summary, if you have less adiponectin, it means that you have less fat burning, less glucose utilization. There's a greater chance of you being overweight and obese and having type 2 diabetes. But if you have normal levels of adiponectin because your gene is working efficiently and you're eating right and taking care of yourself, that's important too. It's not just about the genes. You gotta take care of the good ones that are working for you. So normal adiponectin means less inflammation in the body, less chance of becoming a diabetic. What is the intervention for somebody who finds that they have a SNP? Well, you want to be in a low-carb diet for sure, and you also are a good candidate for a too high of a fat diet. Like, you can have a little bit of fat, but mostly your fats need to come from olive oil, avocado oil, fish oil. Monounsaturated fatty acids, of course, are like olive oil. And, of course, your omega-3 fatty acids are great for you. Fish oil, krill oil, of course. And then, of course, calorie restriction works. That actually is the most effective way for you to lose weight. So just a summary, the main takeaway here is here's some genes that show without any doubt that we can't all be on a high saturated fat diet. It's all about what the genes are telling us now. It's a game changer in what we've been knowing for years about health and about food, about diet. Caffeine. Wow. I mean, just looking at a piece of chocolate or smelling a cup of coffee immediately makes people get excited. And, you know, those foods are very addictive. So if you start eating them or drinking them today, then you're going to want them tomorrow, too, or even later on in the day, because they're very, very addictive. What they do is caffeine and sugar, and they usually come together. You know, a chocolate candy bar usually has sugar in it. Both of those, the caffeine and the sugar, raise your dopamine. There's a little area of our brain called the nucleus accumbens, and that area of the brain produces the dopamine, and then we feel wonderful. Dopamine is the reward brain chemical, so we feel great until it wears off, of course, and then we want to go back for a little more of that high. So what about caffeine? Is it good for you or not? Well, there are so many studies showing that it's very beneficial. And then there's a lot of people that say, I can't touch it. It makes my heart race. Definitely one time that you shouldn't have caffeine is when a woman's pregnant. You don't want to take something stimulating when you're pregnant because you're stimulating the baby. So no exposure during pregnancy for sure. But again, caffeine can be very, very beneficial for certain people and not so beneficial for people who have the CYP1A2. Whenever you see the CYP, CYP, in front of a bunch of letters or numbers, you can tell that's what's called the cytochrome P450 gene, and that you're talking about liver enzymes here. So if you have the CYP1A2, you don't clear caffeine from your liver. And it will remain in your body longer. It will keep you wired longer. There's certain times when that matters a lot. Like if you're trying to get a good night's sleep, you might have had some chocolate dessert for dinner, and then you can't get rested enough to really sleep deeply. It also matters if you have the high blood pressure gene that we talked about earlier. So be careful if you have, say, the high blood pressure gene and you've got the CYP1A2. They don't go well together, just like high blood pressure and salt don't go well together. Now, does that mean you should avoid caffeine 100%? Maybe not. First of all, you might be fine with a very small amount in the morning. And I say in the morning because then you'll have more time to clear it before you go to sleep. And if you can control yourself and keep it to just one little square, then you might be just fine with it. One cup of coffee is 80 milligrams. You'll see studies that recommend anywhere from 225 to 425 milligrams. How could somebody take in that much caffeine in a day? Well, let's say you're one of those people that have 5 or 6 cups a day, but let's say you're a child and you're getting your caffeine from your drinks. There's a lot of kids, teenagers, and college-age students are drinking these drinks that have a lot of caffeine in them, and they're very much at risk, especially if they have the CYP1A2. So this is a really good gene to know about. One of the things you can find out from a gene test is what are the vitamins that you might have a hard time keeping in your body. Like you might have a problem keeping your vitamin C levels up or your vitamin D levels up or your vitamin E, for example, or certain B vitamins, because you'll tend to burn them out too fast or not assimilate them. So that's an important thing to learn about gene testing, which I will not go into in this program, but we'll be able to explain more later on. And the one, you know, vitamin that I really would like to cover, though, is vitamin D. Now, this is a very popular vitamin. I think everybody knows that they should be having vitamin D, and a lot of people are probably taking vitamin D, but should they? Is it really right for them? And can you get enough vitamin D from the sun? So there's more than one vitamin D gene. There's a vitamin D gene that tells if you're absorbing the vitamin D from the sun. Also another gene that tells you how well you carry the vitamin D around in your body and get it to the cells. And then there's also the vitamin D receptor gene, and that's the one I would like to talk about. The three SNPs for vitamin D are the GC gene, the CYP, so CYP, you see that CYP, so you know right away that you're talking about your liver. This is a liver enzyme again. That's the CYP27B1. And this is the gene that is an enzyme that activates vitamin D. 65% of us have a problem with this. The GC gene, 22% of us have a problem with transporting the vitamin D in our blood into our cells. And then there's the DHCR7. So all these genes, all three of them, will give you lower levels of vitamin D. You will have a tendency to be deficient in vitamin D. You might have one of, say, the GC gene and one of the DHCR7. So this is, that's homozygous. It's like being homozygous because you've got one, which is heterozygous, and another one, which is heterozygous, but you put a one and a one together and you've got homozygous. So it's like a red dot. It's like a warning sign that you do really want to watch your vitamin D intake. So let's talk about the vitamin D receptor because it's extremely common. As much as 85% of children with autism have the vitamin D receptor. And of course, vitamin D is really an important vitamin. It isn't even a vitamin. It's really a hormone. If you have a SNP in your VDR, so that's what you would look it up as, is the VDR gene, vitamin D receptor. If you have a SNP in the VDR, that means that your receptor sites, that's the place on the cell that receives the vitamin D, they are blocked and they will not let the vitamin D get into your cell. Now, as I've mentioned before, so very often there are simple fixes for these genes. And the fix for the vitamin D receptor is sulforaphane. Sulforaphane is a molecule that you'll find in certain foods like cabbage and broccoli, well, the cruciferous vegetables, the ones that have the bitter taste to them that some people with the bitter tasting gene are avoiding. But in the cruciferous family, particularly in broccoli and broccoli seed, this is how you're going to obtain your sulforaphane. However, it's not directly in the plant and in the broccoli or in the Brussels sprout. It's the precursor to sulforaphane is there. You have two little sacs that are sitting beside each other. One of them has an enzyme. One of them has another molecule. And when those two sacs are broken, like if you chew into it, bite into it, or cut it with a knife, or put it in a blender and blend it, or right here, what I'm showing you are fermented vegetables, fermented, what we call cultured vegetables. So if you shred up the cabbage and you ferment it, you know, pack it in a jar and ferment it, you're getting a food that's very, very rich in sulforaphane. Now, I happen to have the vitamin D receptor SNP. I eat a lot of fermented foods, and this is why my vitamin D levels tend to stay high. I don't need a lot of vitamin D supplementation, a high amount. This is a perfect example of how foods can be a fix or an intervention for a gene, and it's a great example of how wonderful fermented foods are for you as well. Now, let's talk about special genes for the gut. Let's sort of tie the concept of the genes with the concept of the microbiome and the gut together. If you have certain gene mutations or SNPs or variations, it's really a wake-up call to be very careful about your gut health. And there are a couple of genes I want you to know about so that when you check your genes, you can check and see if you have these genes or not. Because if you have them, you're definitely more at risk for gut problems all throughout your life. So I've listed some of the common genes that I've come across. I'm always looking what genes would have an effect on the gut. So some of the genes that I've found are the vitamin D receptor, the FUT2, the MTHFR, which we talked about earlier, the celiac genes that we talked about earlier, of course, DQ2.5 and DQ8, another gene called the ATG16L1, the IRGM, the APOA4, you know, there's an APOE and there's an APOA, so we're talking about APOA4, and the CYP2E1. I'll just talk about a couple of these. The CYP, remember that tells you right away that we're talking about a liver enzyme. We're talking about the liver here. So this is an enzyme found in the liver, the CYP2E1. You will have trouble with alcohol if you have this gene. There's another gene for alcohol called the ALDH gene. A lot of Asian people have this gene, and if they drink alcohol, they get very flushed, really even sick to their stomach, their face and ears turn very red, and often they don't drink because of that, because it's a very miserable feeling. Maybe 40% of the Asian population have this gene. So you won't find those people drinking usually, but this other gene, the CYP2E1, again, alcohol is going to give you even more of a problem on the body culture diet. We don't recommend alcohol anyway because many, many people have yeast, systemic yeast in their body. The yeast are always producing a toxin called acetaldehyde. Acetaldehyde is the same toxin that's produced by alcohol. So basically, with a systemic yeast infection, you're kind of got like alcohol in your bloodstream all the time. Of course, it affects your brain and fogginess, and it's just really not healthy. So if you check out this CYP, the CYPE21, and you have it, then you know you're much more sensitive to alcohol than other people and should avoid it. One of the most important genes that I always check when I'm looking at someone's genetic wellness report is the FUT2 gene. If you have the FUT2 gene, you're definitely at risk for gut diseases. And there are studies on that. This study on this slide is a study that talks about the gut microbiome and the FUT2 gene and how people with FUT2 are at much greater risk for Crohn's and colitis. But there's a lot more to say about that if you have this gene. Remember, genes are there from the moment of our conception. So let's say you're a baby growing in the womb and you are about to enter the world. And now it's very, very important that you establish a healthy gut microbiome inside of you. And let's say you have this FUT2 gene. Well, another name for this gene is a non-secretor. What very few people know is that our blood type, like if you're an A or an O or a B, you're actually secreting your blood molecules, your sugars. Like all of the blood types have a sugar molecule. So if you're an A, you have A sugar molecules. If you're an O, you're secreting O sugar molecules. And these molecules are going into your tears, into your saliva in your mouth, into the sweat on your skin, but also into your gut mucus. So if I'm an A, which I am, then I would, and I'm a secretor, then I'm secreting my A sugar molecules into my tears and mouth, saliva, sweat, and gut mucus lining. If you are a non-secretor, you are not secreting your blood type into these really important places in the body. For example, if you're a non-secretor, then you're not getting these sugar molecules into your mouth. And why is that important? Because the sugar molecules feed bacteria, particularly the bifidus bacteria. If you're a non-secretor, you're not secreting your blood type into your gut lining, really, basically, into the mucus of your gut, the mucus that lines your gut. So that means that the sugar molecules aren't there to feed the bacteria, not there to feed the bifidus bacteria, so you just will be deficient in bifidus bacteria. And a FUT2 non-secretor has to be even more careful to take in bifidus bacteria. Take it in as a supplement. It will make such a difference in your, well, for example, constipation, but it protects the gut very, very much. You can even swish it around in your mouth. There's several companies that make probiotics for the mouth because it's another area that you want to protect as well. If you are a non-secretor and you have one or two copies of the FUT2 SNP, you're going to have more inflammation in your gut, more inflammation in your gums. So watch carefully for this gene. The RS number for FUT2 is 601338. So do some research on this. It's an important one. Again, no one knows about this. I'd like to get the word out. And, you know, when you check your gene report, whether it's 23andMe or you go to a genetic wellness counselor, be sure you check for FUT2. Most of the good, high-quality tests out in the market today do test FUT2. And there's even some labs where you can ask specifically to have this particular gene tested. Now, the other important thing to know about FUT2 is that if you've got a SNP or a variation in the FUT2 gene, besides being a non-secretor of your blood sugars, you're also going to have low levels of B12, most likely, unless you're eating a diet that's high in B12. Let's say you're a vegetarian and you're not getting any animal protein, you're not getting any B12, you're even more at risk here. So in a FUT2 non-secretor, your vitamin B12 levels are about 16% lower than in somebody that's a non-carrier that has the gene functioning properly. So again, these people are non-secretors. They're extremely resistant, however, and this is kind of a good thing, to viruses, certain strains of noroviruses. So they're often people who say, you know, I never get a virus, I never get sick. One good thing about being a non-secretor is that you're not secreting your sugar into these special places, these tissues. So the virus can infect the cell because it can't find the cell. You want to check this gene because the secretor status, whether you're a secretor or not, determines your resistance to parasite and yeast. There's an enzyme in our gut called intestinal alkaline phosphatase that's an important enzyme for handling fats. You'll have more problems handling fats if you're a non-secretor, a FUT2 non-secretor. The composition of your gut bacteria will be off. You won't have that healthy diversity that you need in a gut, healthy gut. You'll have issues with blood clotting. Your level of carbohydrate tolerance will be poor. And think about this. Think about a baby starting life and his mother. He's inherited the FUT2 gene from his mother. She's a non-secretor as well. So in her breast milk, she doesn't have the sugar molecules either to be able to feed the bacteria in the baby's gut and help that inner ecosystem grow early in life. This is such an important gene. I hope you listen to this part of the presentation over again several times and really understand this. And I actually couldn't end this part of the presentation without talking to you about one of my favorite genes. It's the NRF2 gene. Now, I just love the way this gene looks. There's something really cute about it, isn't it? Like NRF2, NRF2. It's actually an important gene because it's the master regulator of aging. And I talked about sulforaphane earlier. Sulforaphane is very, very important for the NRF2 gene. Sulforaphane enters your bloodstream. It triggers a release of the NRF2 protein into your bloodstream, and then the NRF2 activates over 200 genes, and these genes are antioxidant genes. They're genes that flush out heavy metals, and they help suppress tumor. So this is called the master regulator of anti-aging. And where can you find sulforaphane? I want to remind you once again that sulforaphane is found in delicious fermented foods. I would not have a major meal during my day without some fermented vegetables. I don't use the term, by the way, sauerkraut, because years ago there weren't any fermented foods in the country, and I started to teach the world about these fermented foods. And you know, I use the term sauerkraut, and people would go into the store and they'd buy something in a jar. It was pasteurized, it had vinegar in it, citric acid, and I thought, That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about freshly made live vegetables that have been cut up and allowed to ferment. So I changed the term to from sauerkraut to either cultured vegetables, or we say fermented vegetables. People are still using the term sauerkraut today because 20 years later, everybody, I think, or at least everybody in the health world, knows about the importance of the fermented food. So they're getting away with sauerkraut today. I couldn't do that years ago. So you'll hear me talking about cultured vegetables and fermented vegetables all the time. Why would you want to eat fermented foods like cultured vegetables, young coconut kefir, the probiotic liquids that we have, our protein powders that are all contained, you know, they've all been fermented? Well, they contain a robust community of microbes. They contain a diversity of microbes that you won't find in probiotic supplements. So let me explain that a little bit more. If you are a scientist or microbiologist and you put together a formula of, say, bifidus bacteria, that's great, or combination of lactobacillus and bifidus bacteria to create a probiotic, that's useful because you do want these bacteria in the human gut. But if you eat fermented foods, what you're doing is you're going, let's say you're going out into the field and you're picking a head of cabbage or two or three, you're bringing that cabbage in, you're slicing, you know, shredding it and packing it in a jar, and then you're fermenting it. Now, during the fermentation process, the bacteria start to grow and multiply enormously so that there's just trillions more than there was in the beginning. Now, let's go back to the cabbage when it was growing in the garden. There, from the very beginning of the cabbage's life, bacteria colonized, and they begin to grow on top of the cabbage and inside, you know, where they can get to and the surfaces of the cabbage. And they begin to form a very sophisticated, very special symbiotic relationship with each other. These bacteria, they were protecting the plant, the little head of cabbage. And then as it grew and grew and grew, it continued to protect the cabbage. And then one day you come and pick it and take it in and you ferment it. So the bacteria that were on that plant are I always call it the wisdom of nature. They're on there. They're working together as a community. We can't really ever duplicate that ourselves in the lab. I'm totally for probiotic supplements, but I think absolutely you must have fermented foods in your diet. We have products like our probiotic liquids, for example, where, you know, over in Australia where they're made at the moment, the organic grains like quinoa and millet, the brown rice, the chickpea, they're brought in from the field and they are, the bacteria are taken or cultured off of them and then actually they're exposed to bad things like antibiotics, for example, and birth control pills that would normally kill the bacteria and they do kill some of the bacteria, but the bacteria that are remaining are resistant to that antibiotic. And so they continue to grow those out. And then that's what you're getting in a bottle of our probiotic liquid. It's a really special probiotic. Probiotic foods and probiotic liquids, like we offer in Body Ecology, are excellent for a healthy gut. And of course, now you know that they're very important for positively expressing those genes that you want to keep working for you, the ones that are going to protect you against diabetes, protect you against cancer, protect you against heart disease, and so on. I can't do a presentation like this without talking more about fermented foods and fermented liquids. The best ones, the ones that we recommend in the Body Ecology diet, are cultured vegetables or fermented vegetables and young coconut kefir. They contain a robust community of microbes. They have the diversity that we want in our gut. We want a diversity of bacteria. You won't find that in probiotic supplements. A little bit goes a long way, like a tablespoon or two of the cultured vegetables with your meal is fantastic. 4 ounces or so of the coconut kefir once or twice a day. Our probiotic liquids, just a few ounces twice a day. We also have our fermented herbal blends. One is for detoxification, the other one for people with candidiasis. One thing about the fermented foods, they all stop your cravings for sugar and carbohydrates. They keep for months. You know, you make up a batch of fermented vegetables. You're still eating them 4 or 5 months later, and they're good to go. And quite frankly, if you get into fermented foods, I think many of you will find that they're very fun, very easy to make. Once they're made up, they're the ultimate fast food. Not all fermented foods are good for you. We do not recommend any fermented foods that have wild yeast in them. Kombucha, beer, wine, those are examples of wild fermentation. Sourdough bread is wild fermentation. If you have SIBO or you know someone who does, please let them know that until that pathogen in the small intestine is wiped out, fermented foods with lactobacillus aren't good for you. So at that time, you wouldn't be eating the cultured vegetables or the other products, but you definitely want to have the bifidus. We have a multi-pack. These little packets with different with a livamin and a mineral supplement and some bifidus and an enzyme in it. And you can take this with each with one of your meals, and it has wonderful bifidus bacteria in it. And there's something about the putting those particular four little capsules together. They have amazing synergy, and we have raves over this product. It's just you take one pack when you're eating a meal. So that's our multi-pack, Body Ecology's multi-pack. But again, just to focus on the SIBO, do not eat fermented foods if you have SIBO. If you eat them and you have a reaction, like a whole lot of gas and bloating, and it stays there for days, that's a very good indication that you have SIBO. And then I mentioned earlier about a protocol that we use, but you want to kill them with herbs like oil of oregano, cat's claw. Berberine is excellent. And at the same time, you want to be taking some serrapeptidase. It's an enzyme that helps to break up the biofilms. It's good to know that fermented foods, the bacteria in fermented foods, are very good at breaking up biofilms. But in this particular case, they're in the small intestine. You need to wipe them out and then start populating over again the bacteria in the colon. Most of the bacteria should be living in the colon, not in the small intestine. When the good bacteria or the bad bacteria live in the small intestine, that's what we call SIBO. Repopulating the gut, getting all those wonderful bacteria in there and building that healthy microbiome, expressing our genes in a popular way, getting the bacteria in our gut that have their own genes that are working with our genes. That's what this is all about. It's an extraordinary science that we've never had before. New understanding of what it really means to be healthy. If you haven't had these two tools working for you, you've got to start taking care of your gut and finding out what kind of genes you have, then putting what you discover into action. So where do you go about getting your genes tested? Well, right now there's some companies that are offering testing that are excellent. You're probably going to see a whole lot more spring up because this is going to be such a hot field. You're really stepping into this at the very beginning. It's a very exciting time, though, and I'm so excited for you that you're learning this. I think a lot of people know about 23andMe. It's a $99 test. They don't tell you much. You can go over to a website called Genetic Genie, and you can follow through there what they tell you to do, and you get your information from 23andMe, and then they interpret two parts of the 23andMe test for you. They give you information on something called methylation and something called detoxification. And that's really good to know. But there's so many other genes to test, like the Smart DNA test, over 100 different genes for $4.99. There's Fit Genes. Pathway Genomics is another one. Some of these companies, like Pathway, they will work with your doctor to take insurance. Geneva Diagnostics will test for certain genes. They take insurance, too, if you're working with a doctor. And they're quite expensive, and they usually don't test, but a few genes at a time. So I personally myself work more with Smart DNA. I like having over 100 genes tested for $4.99. Now, these companies want to work with a nutritional genomic counselor because, and this, by the way, is one of the reasons they kind of cut the wings on 23andMe and didn't let them just give out information. Because what are you going to do with that for information? You need to work with somebody who can look at your genes and then look at how they relate to each other. For example, let's say you have the genes for diabetes, which I do. I have quite a few SNPs for diabetes. which is interesting because I wasn't aware of it. And you know, I don't know anybody in my family that has diabetes. But you don't want to just look at the diabetes genes. You want to go over and look at your stress genes, like COMP and some other stress genes. Because if you are easily stressed out, then your sugar is going to go up all the time. Your cortisol goes up, your sugar will go up, and that's going to cause you to be insulin resistant and then develop diabetes. And diabetes is an awful disease. You might think, oh, I don't want to have to take insulin. It's a crummy disease. I hope I don't have that. But it's much more than that. It's a disease that develops and continues. You get worse and worse, and then you have dementia. And also you lose your eyesight. You know, can you imagine millions more blind, demented people in this world shortly because there's 79 million baby boomers getting older by the second. So this is important information that we're learning here right now. We're looking at a world in a lot of trouble, and people don't even realize that we are in trouble for the most part. So you can be one of those people who can change your life. If we can empower you here to become somebody who's healthy, you can teach a lot of other people how to be well too, and we can turn around the situation that we have here. The gene companies definitely prefer that you work with a genomic wellness consultant, somebody who's been trained in this information, because you don't want to just look at the genes alone. You want to look at genes in relationship to each other. For example, if you do have the salt-sensitive genes, then you want to look at, well, do you have, are you at risk for cardiovascular disease? Are you at risk for high blood pressure? So those would be some genes that you would look at together. The diabetes genes, which are very common, you don't want to just look at those. You want to look at the stress genes like COMP and some other genes. Why? Because your cortisol goes up when you're stressed, and that raises your sugar. So that's going to make a person insulin resistant. A lot of person who is under a lot of stress is going to have high levels of sugar in their body, and they, if they've got these genes, they're going to be the ones who are most at risk for diabetes. But that's not it. I also like to go over and look at the genes for bone density. If a person is at risk for osteopenia, osteoporosis, weak bones, then of course the genes for diabetes and the genes for weak bones are very much connected to each other. So we look at those as well. That's just a simple example of why it's important to look at your genes in relation to each other and why working with a genomic wellness counselor is important. Disease begins in your gut. People know that. They've said that many, many times. And I always say health begins there as well. But now we have another important piece of the puzzle. We know that it's not just about your gut. It's also about your genes. And having a gut-smart, gene-smart diet, like the Body Ecology Diet, is the smartest thing that you can do today. So the big takeaway here is that I hope you understand that disease begins in the gut, and what you eat is very, very important for a healthy gut, for the genes of the microbes in your gut, and your own genes. Yes, disease begins in the gut, but health begins there too. And we have this incredible new science now that's going to be able to help us know exactly what's right for us. It's really amazing. You can see why I'm so excited. I hope you're excited too. So Body Ecology, just to tell you a little bit more about Body Ecology, my company that I formed over 25 years ago and has been helping tens of thousands of people all over the world. We have sort of a cult following. Body Ecology is very focused on healing the gut. We really are, if you study the gut and if you study the genes, the perfect gut smart, gene smart diet. And, you know, both of these fields are really important fields to know. They're deep fields. There's a lot to know. And if you stay close to us, sign up for our newsletter, for example, and participate in courses and things that we're offering, you'll be able to begin to deepen your understanding of both these areas now. We have a very clear understanding in Body Ecology of the inner ecosystem, the microbiome, the use of fermented foods and probiotic beverages. Food combining is very, very important for a healthy gut. If you eat a lot of weird food altogether, which we do all the time, it's just too hard on the digestive tract to digest that. We're real into preparing foods properly so that they can be digested. And of course, we highly recommend the use of digestive enzymes. Fermented foods contain the bacteria and they're secreting enzymes all the time, so they're helping us digest the foods. And then we have a rule, the 80-20 rules, or actually two of them, that improve digestion too. So if you've got a digestive problem or you have a digestive tract, I think you'll find being part of the body ecology family really is a great place to be. And here's a little bit of food for thought. Fermented foods are the key to optimal health. We have a great understanding and have for over 20 years about the importance of these fermented foods and how they are the key to optimal health. A big takeaway here is that fermented foods are the key to optimal health. They have a positive effect on our microbiome and therefore gut health, of course, and on our genes. And what they do contain is a wonderful, wonderful ingredient. Of course, they contain fantastic bacteria, lots and lots of them if you make them in the way I've taught people to make using the starter culture, for example. But they contain sulforaphane. Sulforaphane is that magical ingredient that is found in the cruciferous family, especially in broccoli seed and broccoli seed extract. And you'll find a lot of it in fermented foods. Sulforaphane expresses the NRF2 gene. It opens up the vitamin D receptor, and I'm sure in the future we'll find many, many more purposes for it. But the NRF2 gene, remember, is the master anti-aging gene for aging. That's why years ago when Eli Michnikoff said when people are eating fermented foods, he noticed that they lived longer, healthier lives. I really want you to remember, too, that healing is absolutely delicious. We have a recipe book full of recipes. The Body Ecology Diet book, the one I wrote over 20 years ago, has delicious recipes. The new book has many, many more recipes. All of them are absolutely delicious. I made a commitment that I was going to help the world eat better, help people heal, but also do it with delicious foods. We have produced the Healthy Gut Summit. Its debut is the week of November 9th to the 16th, 2015. If you're listening to this after that date, you can still purchase it anytime at bodyecology.com. And thank you very much from the bottom of my heart for caring enough about yourself to learn this important new information. I'd love for you to subscribe to our podcast. That's where I'm able to interview a lot of wonderful guests. I'm very committed to changing the way the world eats and creating a happier, healthier world. We have to do that for our children and our grandchildren and for generations to come. Let's do that together.